I've enjoyed the last 3 weeks and the sermons that I've preached on heaven as much as I have enjoyed any series that I've ever preached in the past. Now, I'm not speaking for any of you, but I've been really encouraged by that, by seeing these images, as we've called them glimpses of glory. As we've looked at specifically the text there at the end of the book of Revelation in chapters 21 and 22, and we see these images of the holy city, of the bride of Christ, and of the paradise of God. And this lesson series was primarily intended for us as Christians. This is our hope. This is what we look forward to. This is what we have the expectation of. But a question that has come up in my own mind and in my own heart, as these lessons have been preached and as I've been encouraged by the study that has gone into them, what if a non-Christian could see this? What if they could get a glimpse of that glory? What kind of an impact could it make on them if they could truly see the hope that Christians have? But let's be real. Most non-Christians, they aren't going to see that. They aren't going to get a glimpse of that. You know what they get a glimpse of? You know what most non-Christians see? They see us. How disappointing in comparison, and yet how vital to the plan God has made to bring people to Him. And what do they see when they see us? Well, just an imitation, and sometimes a poor imitation at that, of all of this glory. It is a glimpse of glory, if you want to put it in those terms. An imitation. What does that call to mind if you say an imitation? Well, we know the phrase, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. But sometimes it seems like that phrase was just invented to make us feel better when somebody steals something from us. An imitation is rarely viewed as a good thing. I wouldn't be thrilled if for my birthday someone got me imitation ping golf clubs from China. That wouldn't excite me. I wouldn't be glad for that. How would you feel if at Christmas you got these, what do you want to call them, see no vestry shoes instead of Converse? It's an imitation. It's a knockoff instead of the real thing. A good Elvis impersonator, we've had good Elvis impersonators come to Lufkin, and they sell out the Pines Theater, right? But let's be honest, he's no Elvis. And if the real Elvis were to come to town, whether in his heyday or whether he's really still out there somewhere and he would come into town, imagine everybody coming to see. We have comedians who do impressions, right? It's an imitation. And those impressions make us laugh. But the one being made fun of usually isn't very thrilled by it. And rarely are they good enough to be anything more than a rough outline, a caricature of the original. But every once in a while, an imitation is so close, so true in its recreation of the original, that it reminds us so much of the real thing that we appreciate it. And we are made to yearn for the genuine article based on the imitation. My great-grandmother, her name was Mary. She died when I was 10 years old. Her name to us was Wangy. Don't ask me why. That's just what we called her. And Wangy was the best cook that I've ever tasted. She made these rolls, and she made them with just about everything. You know, back in the day like that, they'd get up and make rolls basically every day. And I guess that's how she got so good at it, the 10,000-hour rule or whatever it is. They were light and yet substantial rolls. They were airy but doughy at the same time. They had a flavor that cannot and will not be matched in the history of mankind. And you could eat them with anything. I mean, I'd eat tacos with rolls on the side if they were those rolls. You could put gravy on them. You could eat them straight like that. They were so good that I would pass up her desserts. And she was known for her desserts just so that I could eat more of those rolls with honey on them. And to this day, I've never tasted any rolls as good as what she made. But she passed a recipe on to my grandmother. My grandmother listens to my sermons sometimes. Hopefully she didn't hear this, but she knows it's true. Her roles were never as good as my great-grandmother's. They were close. And when I would eat them, you know what it would bring to mind? All of those memories of my great-grandmother's roles. But not just her roles, everything else that went with that wonderful woman. And would cause in my heart a yearning for the original. Now, what does that have to do with us? Well, we are all to be imitators of glory. Paul said, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." In another place, he encourages us to note those who walk like him because he walks like Christ, and we imitate those who walk like him because they imitate him who imitates Christ. It is an imitation of an imitation of an imitator of glory. And that seems like it's a long way off. But if we do this right, this imitation will give those who see us a glimpse of Jesus. And if they get a true glimpse of Jesus, then they too will yearn to know the original. That's our purpose. That's what we're trying to do. And yes, we imitate Jesus because that's who we are called to be internally. This isn't something that we're faking. But at the same time, we do it so that we might influence others. And what a powerful influence it can and should be if people can see glimpses of Jesus in me. You know, there are lots of images that are used in our Bibles of imitating Christ. But I want us to think about four this morning. The most familiar image is that we reflect him and we reflect him to others. Open up your Bible, if you would, to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. We'll begin reading in verse 14. These are probably verses you're familiar with. But turn over to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 14. I want to welcome our visitors. We appreciate your presence, and we hope that you have glimpsed Jesus even in our services this morning. And if there is anything we can do to help you grow closer to him, that's what we want to do. As we strive to be what we find here in Matthew 5 and verse 14, as Jesus describes his people, the citizens of his kingdom, he says, you, if you're a Christian, raise your hand. Raise your hand. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Jesus is explicit. You are the light of the world. And yet, in another place in the Gospels, in John chapter 8 and verse 12, he says, again, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So which is it? Are we the light of the world, or is Jesus the light of the world? Well, you know the answer. We are a reflection of him. Right after I started preaching, I heard a brother who was not a preacher by trade or vocation. I heard him use an illustration in a Wednesday night invitation talk. And you've probably heard it, but it was the first time I had ever heard it. It was about the sun, the moon, and the world. We know that the moon has no internal light source, but when it is positioned correctly, the sun shines on it to such a degree that it can light up that part of the world that is in darkness, what we call night. And the moon isn't as bright as the sun, it's just a reflection. But it is bright enough that we can see clearly enough to know where we're going, to see what's around us. And it's truly amazing, if you stop to think about it, that the sun's brightness, its light from so far away, is so powerful that it can light up a giant rock that is moving around the sun to the degree that we can see. Now, at this point, the brother that I'm talking about, he's given his invitation and he says, now I want you to see the illustration here. The sun is Jesus. He is the light. And he gave his invitation, and people said, stand and sing. And we went out to eat afterwards, and we're talking about him. I even complimented him. I said, Dwight, good invitation. I appreciated that. And it's like a light bulb went off in his head, and he said, I forgot the whole point. We are the moon. And he didn't say it. But we see the illustration, don't we? We have no true light in ourselves, but we reflect the light of the world. We give them a glimpse of that light to the degree that they can see well enough to seek out the true light. We reflect Jesus, not in His fullness, not in His perfection, but we give a glimpse of His light when we live like Him. They can see our good works and glorify us. No, glorify our Father in heaven who created us for those good works. And so we reflect Jesus, but we also look like Him. Turn to Romans chapter 8, if you would. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 28. And we know, the text says, that all things work together for. So who are we talking about? What group of people? They work together for good to those who love God. These are the ones. These are the type. This is the type of person who is under consideration. Somebody who loves God. Well, things work together for good for them, to those who are the called according to His purpose, for whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom He predestined, these He also called. Whom He called, He also justified. And whom He justified, these He also glorified. And so God had in His mind from before the foundation of the world, not just that He was going to send Jesus, but also that He was going to have a group of people, those who love Him. And those people He was going to conform to the image of His Son. We are supposed to look a certain way, is the idea. And Jesus is the firstborn among many brethren. And the image there is that of an older brother, that Jesus is first. And yet God has all of these children who look and act and think like Jesus. I mean, we see this with real siblings all the time, don't we? This is a picture of Maddie when she was 4 years old. Brooklyn was just a few months old at this time. And if you wanted to know what this baby was going to look like, what image could you look at? This one right here, right? At 4 years old, that's pretty close. And we don't look like Jesus in every single way, but we need to strive to. That needs to be the goal. For us, spiritually, we should look a lot like our older brother, because the way we act is the way he would act. It's put another way in Colossians chapter 3, if you turn over there. Colossians chapter 3, starting there in verse 9. Actually, start in verse 8. But now you yourselves are to put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. That's the way we acted. That's the way we looked before. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to what? According to the image of Him who created him. If you've received Christ, you walk in Him. You walk like Him. Where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free, but Christ is all and in all. We are the very image of Christ. Again, we reflect Him, not like the moon, but even closer. We reflect Him like an image in a mirror. And when people see us, they should see Jesus. And it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter what you look like physically. Whether you're Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, nor free. Whether you're from West Texas or East Texas, whether you're a Southerner or, dare I say, a Yankee. Doesn't matter. If you're a Christian, you look like Christ. And all of a sudden that becomes more important than all of those other physical things. He is all and He is in all, as we'll come back to here in just a second. So we reflect Him, we look like Him. A third image is that He is on us, or that we put Him on. Turn to Romans chapter 13 and verse 14. Romans 13 and 14. Again, we're told in verse 13, walk properly, not in revelry and drunkenness and lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. It's interesting that both of these occasions give us long lists of the things we're not supposed to be that we were before. And then instead of giving us a long list of the things we're supposed to be, it just tells us, look at Jesus, be like Him. Verse 14, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. So we put Him on. Like what? Not like a costume. We aren't pretending, but like a uniform. We are recognized as belonging to Him. We are on His team. We are in His army. He is on us, and so we wear Jesus in that way. So when people see us, they see the name of Christ. They associate us with Him and His image. But my favorite description, my favorite image of imitating Christ is this concept that He is in us. Turn, if you would, to Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. Back there in Colossians, we read that Christ is all and He is in all. In Galatians 2, Paul puts it this way. Galatians 2 and verse 20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. It's no longer I who live, Paul says, but Christ lives in me. A few years ago, right out there in that foyer, I had a conversation with a young man who was in college, and it was about God dwelling in us, specifically the Holy Spirit dwelling in us, and how does that work? And so I brought him to this passage. I said, well, what do you think that means? What do you think that means that Christ is in us? And he says, well, you know, it's symbolic. I said, good. What is it symbolic of? He said, well, it's symbolic of Christ being in you. Well, that's what it says. That's good. We're making progress. What does that mean that Christ is in you? Does it mean perform open heart surgery? You know, just open me up. Hey, there's Christ. No, no, no. Okay, well, what does it mean? And he said, it's like He's in you because you act like Him. Bingo. That's it, isn't it? I want Christ's character to be in me to the degree that I can say, as Paul did, it is no longer I who live. It's not Reagan anymore. And when somebody sees me walking around, living my life, doing my thing, they could be able to say, that's Christ. That's Jesus. Because Reagan is going to act the way Jesus acts. I'm a long way from that. But that's the goal. That's what we're working toward, where we can say, Christ is in me. Because whatever Christ would do, that's what I want to do. What do people see when they see me? I want them to see Jesus, at least a glimpse of Him and who He is. But let's be honest. We've known each other a long time. No one is ever going to confuse any of us for Jesus, least of all me. But if we can give them glimpses, what an impact it could make. There's a phrase that's been very popular since I was a kid. WWJD, what would Jesus do, right? And certainly that's a great question to ask. When it comes to the things that we do in our life, what would Jesus do in this scenario? I want to act the way He acted. But may I suggest that we can't really answer that question until we answer the far less catchy question, WWJL. What was Jesus like? When he was in the flesh, tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin, what was he like? And if we are truly going to fulfill any of these images of imitating Christ, reflecting him, looking like him, him being on us or him being in us, we have to know who he was and see him for who he truly was. Another way of asking this is, what qualities did Jesus possess? And so I've been thinking about this over the last couple of weeks. I've been putting together a list. I stopped at 26 characteristics. And you say, why 26? Well, originally I was going to make a list of 10 characteristics. That didn't work out very well. So I said, I'll make 20 characteristics, and still going strong. And so I said, I'll make 25. And I'm trying to narrow down the list of all of these things. And so I finally came to this list of 26. This is comprehensive. Of course not. In fact, I've given you some blanks on your handout where you can add more qualities that Jesus has. But I would just want to go through these very quickly together. I know you can read this, but for the sake of the people listening and listening only, let's go through them. Self-sacrifice, mercy, grace, justice, righteous indignation, long-suffering, confidence, humility, meekness, love, compassion, kindness, service, spiritual mindedness, purpose or drive, submission, obedience, endurance, holiness, righteousness, purity, zeal, boldness, passivity, faithfulness, and trustworthiness. That's 26 of how many? And yet these are the things that I need to be striving to put on in my life if I'm going to be like Jesus. And of course, these are not standalone qualities. They are an interwoven tapestry of the perfect character of Christ. And I look at that list, even though I consider myself to be a faithful Christian, I have a lot of work left to do. Not just to have these qualities, but maybe even just as importantly, to have these qualities consistently. It is not just that I'm kind one day, I'm kind every day. And I need to be kind, as you do all the time. For example, I need to be kind even if I'm angry. I need to be kind even if I'm hungry or grumpy or I dislike someone or I've been wronged deeply by someone. And I need to be kind not just all the time, I need to be kind to everyone. I need to be kind to my wife and my kids. But I also need to be kind to the waitress at lunch you're going to see here in just a second, to my boss, to my coworkers, to my employees. I need to be kind to nice people, and I need to be kind to mean people. I need to be kind to powerful people and kind to weak people. Kindness needs to be my character because it was Jesus's character, that they may get a glimpse of him in me. And for every one of these qualities, that's the reality. But it's somewhat overwhelming to consider all of these at once, isn't it? So, my question of application is this. Where do I focus my efforts? And to answer that question, I want you to answer two others. Two questions with this in mind. Where do I focus my efforts? I look at this list. Where do I need to start? Well, two questions. Number one, which quality do you admire most? Hopefully you have the handout there in front of you. Look over that for just a second. Which quality do you admire most in Jesus? That's like trying to pick between a lot of really, really good things. I understand that. But certainly there are some things we look at Jesus and say, that's amazing. I admire that so much in him. Well, I would suggest if you admire it, implement it. And it's really a matter of motivation that we ask this question. If I really admire something in someone, I will be motivated to want to have that in my own life, to implement it in me. In this case, the saying really is true that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I love that about him, and so I want to love that about me too. So what is that for me? We could use your thing that you admire most, but I don't know what that is. I know what the thing I admired most about Jesus. It is his self-sacrifice. How many scriptures could be read to point out this fact, but one that does so very succinctly is 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, what an understatement, he was God, Lord of heaven and earth, though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor. What an understatement. He came and was born of a woman in a manger. He was from Nazareth in some backwater country of Israel. He became poor that you, through his poverty, might become rich. Oh, there's more to that than just his physical standing in life. It is his sacrifice on the cross. From God to the cross. From rich to poor, he sacrificed himself so that we might become rich. I admire that. So I need to implement it. In your family, especially fathers, you have a responsibility to be the example of Christ and be this example in terms of service, of self-sacrifice. You, as the head of the house, are the greatest servant in that house. That's the way it's supposed to be. You sacrifice what you yourself, what you want and desire for the good of everyone else. And do others see that in you, in the home, but also on the job? Are you willing to sacrifice for the good of others? And we say, well, that's a good way to get left behind. That's a good way to get run over. Well, that brings us to the next question. Which quality are you most lacking in Jesus? It is likely that you have most all of these qualities that are listed to one extent or another. We've got a lot of really wonderful people here this morning. But lacking one of these qualities to a great degree can undo all of the good that having the other qualities does in our life. Justice is a great quality, but it is unkind and hurtful if there is no mercy. Love is empty without faithfulness. Zeal is blinded without obedience. So find the area of greatest weakness in your life and work to make that area a strength. Why was Michael Jordan the greatest basketball player of all time? We can have the discussion whether he was or not. You would be wrong if you don't think he was. But why was he the greatest basketball player of all time? Well, I found this quote. I thought it was pretty cool. My attitude, he said, is that if you push me towards something that you think is a weakness, then I will turn that perceived weakness into a strength. Now, he's not the only one who's done this in the history of basketball. But what Michael Jordan would do was, at the end of every season, he would go and he would look at his performance. He would look at who he was as a basketball player, and he would try and hone in at the area where he was weakest. And then he would spend the whole offseason working, concentrating on that area of weakness, so by the time he came back, that area of weakness had become an area of great strength. May I suggest that that's exactly the kind of tact that can be effective for us as well. If you lack it, if it's an area of weakness, work on it. And let's not throw up our hands and say, well, that's not just me. You know, I just don't have that kind of personality. I'm just not this. I'm just not that. If we're going to imitate Jesus, we need to put on these qualities and characteristics. And for every single one of us, there are some that come naturally and some that come more difficultly. And what's amazing is if people who truly know us, if they see us changing that weakness that they know about us, that they perceive in us, if they see us working on that to where it becomes a strength, what kind of an impact will that have on them? They're serious about this Christianity business. They really do want to look like Jesus. And all of that's fine and good until the rubber meets the road and we have to choose and say, this is my weakness. This is my area where I'm not doing a good job. Have you looked at the list? Which one is it? At the end of class, Monty came up to me here just a few minutes ago, and he talked about Isaac, and he said, you know, Isaac is kind of passive in this passage. Here's this teenage boy. His father's wrapping him up and putting him on an altar with a knife and fire on wood. He knew what was going on. He could have fought back. He could have run away. But instead, he allowed himself to be laid on that altar as a type of what Jesus would do. And so I'll admit it. I think the quality that I probably am most lacking is this passivity. Passivity? Jesus was passive? Yes. Lots of occasions, Isaiah 53 and verse 7 describes him. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 39, he encourages us to turn the other cheek. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other to him also. I've never been very good at that. In Matthew 27, verses 12 through 14, twice we see them accusing him of all of the things that they say that he has done, and Pilate is flabbergasted. He says, "Why don't you answer anything?" And yet the text says that he answered them not a word. Why? Why was the God of heaven and earth, the one who is most active, because he is the creator, if you want to put it in those terms, why was he so passive on these occasions? And why does he call us to be the same sometimes? For the good of others? So that we might not receive the credit, so that we might be humble? To not be drawn into a fight of unreasonableness with people who are unreasonable? Sometimes we need to close our mouths. And that's tough. It's tough to close your mouth when you know you're right and they're wrong. But it doesn't really matter. It's tough to close your mouth when somebody else is taking credit for what you think you should receive credit for, but you realize credit is not what it's really all about. And here is the most powerful being in the universe being passive and encouraging in certain circumstances that same passivity. And what I want to be a lot of times, I don't want to be Jesus, I want to be Peter. I want to draw my sword and defend myself and get the last word in. Sometimes I have to bite my tongue and take it, like Jesus. Be meek. Don't get the last word. Don't make it known how much I'm sacrificing for everybody else. Not getting the credit where it is due. Why? For the sake of others. So that they might see Jesus in me. Your answers to these two questions give you a starting point. But may I suggest that that starting point only really applies to those who are Christians this morning. I had you raise your hand a minute ago. I didn't look too closely. But it's likely that there are those here this morning who aren't a Christian. And your starting point, well, it isn't quite the same. It is still imitating Jesus. That's what it's about. But that starting point for you begins by imitating His death, His burial, and His resurrection. You must put off that old man of sin. You must crucify the flesh with its passions and desires. You must put that old man to death. You must be buried as he was buried, but buried in a watery grave that has faith in the working of God, that the same God who rose Jesus from the dead, he can raise you from the dead as well. And coming up out of that watery grave, you can rise to walk in newness of life. You can have a resurrection, being made pure and clean and holy once more. And if you know that's the imitation that you need to make this morning, won't you come now while together we stand? While we sing.